Welcome to Counter Apologetics.
Welcome to Counter Apologetics. I'm your host, Emerson Green, and today we'll be discussing the Euthyphro Dilemma. Believers often claim that, unlike atheists, they have an objective basis for morality. They're not working with what's socially useful or what's preferable to humans or what maximizes flourishing while minimizing suffering, but instead, they're operating from the unassailable, objective standard of God. The idea that our morality is grounded in God's will is what's known as divine command theory, but divine command theory has numerous problems, and one of the oldest problems comes to us from Plato nearly 2,500 years ago. Are right actions commanded by God because they are right, or are right actions right because God commands them? These may not seem radically different upon first glance, but each option, or each horn as they're called, has drastic implications for the nature of morality and God's relationship to it. So when we say that God is good, do we mean that 1, God wills something because it is good, or 2, good is defined as that which God wills? If we take the first horn, God commands good actions because they are good, then God is matching some independent standard of good. He's using some kind of metric, and that's why something like murder is wrong. Good is something wholly independent of God and is not created by God. If this is the case, and good actions are intrinsically good, then a God is actually not necessary for morality. If God is going by some standard, say minimizing suffering or something like that, then why couldn't we just cut out the middleman and go straight to the standard God himself is referring to? If God commands right actions because they are right, then God is entirely superfluous to morality. The second option, or second horn, it's good because God commands it, effectively makes morality arbitrary. There's nothing intrinsically bad about suffering, for example. If God told you to murder someone or torture someone, it would be morally correct by definition. God's command is what makes something right or wrong, and nothing else, which renders actions like murder to be neutral, without God making them wrong. On this view, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with, for example, torturing someone for fun. It's only bad because it goes against God's preferences. Neither of the horns of Euthyphro's dilemma are very desirable to theists, so apologists have largely responded by claiming that this dilemma is a false dichotomy, and they try to craft a third option that gets them out of the undesirable implications of the two horns. Some believers simply bite the bullet and opt for the divine command theory option, but many find it to be unsatisfactory and come up with the third option, which we'll come to in a minute. The second horn, where something is only good because God says so, is the second most popular option. This is what's known as divine command theory. If something is good only because God has said so, then the same act can be good or bad, depending on what God says at that particular time. Killing your child is wrong only because God says not to. And in the Bible, when God commands Abraham to kill his son, killing his child became morally right. And then when he was told not to, it became morally wrong. Or when God instructs parents to kill their disobedient children in the Old Testament law, in Leviticus 20, a rule which Jesus reaffirms twice in the New Testament, Matthew 15 and Mark 7, it becomes morally good to kill your children, given that they disobey you. On divine command theory, nothing is immoral unless God, at that moment, says that it is wrong. God's command alone is what makes something right. But this reduces morality to the whims of an authority where might makes right. Under this option, God is not moral or immoral. He's an amoral being, and all actions are amoral until God issues his opinion on them. It's not that God commands what is good, but rather God commands what he commands, and we call whatever he commands good after the fact. God establishes his moral authority by force. Under divine command theory, moral authority comes from overpowering everyone else. A third option is proposed by apologists who want to say that this is a false dilemma. Goodness is inherent in God's nature in such a way that whatever God wills or commands will be good.
I think, however, that the Euthyphro dilemma is a false dilemma because there's a third alternative. It's not the case that God wills something because it is good, nor is it the case that something is good just because God wills it. Rather, God wills something because He is good. That is to say, it is God's own nature which determines what is the good. God is by nature essentially compassionate, just, fair, kind, loving, and so forth. And because He is good, His commandments to us reflect necessarily His nature. And therefore, the commandments of God and our moral duties are rooted in God's essence. They are not arbitrary. They are rooted in God Himself, but they aren't grounded in anything external to God. God is Himself the good, who is the source of our moral duties.
This would mean that God is not following some standard outside of Himself, which is the first horn, but they're trying to avoid the second horn by saying that His commands are not arbitrary. They're based in His essentially good nature. But where does His nature come from? Why does He have this nature and not some other nature? Is His nature self-created, or did it have to be this way that it happens to be? Let's look at both of these options. On one hand, if He had no choice to have any nature other than the one that He has now, then He's not ultimately the author of morality, because He's not ultimately the author of His nature. And it also implies some mysterious governing rules that are above God that decided His nature had to be the way that it is. On the other hand, if He did choose His nature, or has some control over what His nature is, why did He choose the nature that He has over something else? Neither of these options are good for believers. As for the first option, I don't see how God could have chosen His own nature. How could God choose anything without already having preferences? In other words, how could He prefer one nature over another without already having a nature that governed His preferences? It's unclear to me how it would be possible to choose one thing over another without already having some preferences that are guiding your choice. So if His nature was self-created, then it really would have to be chosen at random, and the basis for morality would be arbitrary in a fundamental sense. As for the second option, God couldn't possibly have any other nature than the one He has. What is this mysterious governing force that God has to obey? If it couldn't have been any other way, there must be something external that God is subject to or some standard that He's going by. Regardless of how God's nature initially came to be, is it possible for God to change His nature? If not, He's not omnipotent, or He doesn't have libertarian free will, or He's subject to something above Himself. If God can change His nature, it's unclear why He prefers the one He has over some other nature, and we're left to think that it must be arbitrary on some level. Now, if this sounds familiar, that's because this is essentially the original Euthyphro dilemma. Is God's nature good because God has it, or does God have His nature because it is good? This third horn hasn't solved the original dilemma, it's simply moved it back one step. In the clip I played, Craig said, God's will isn't arbitrary, but rather operates according to a definite moral standard, God's necessarily good nature. So rather than asking about God's will, we're asking about God's nature. It doesn't solve the Euthyphro dilemma, it just pushes it from God's will or God's commands to God's nature. When we say God's nature is good, do we mean that it's good by some external standard, or do we mean that good is defined as consonant with God's nature? For example, Christians who take this third option say that loving kindness is a part of God's essentially good nature. So is God loving and kind because loving kindness is good? Or is whatever God does going to be called loving kindness no matter what the action is? Neither of these options are very satisfying to believers. I have one more problem with the third horn defense before moving on. It's worth pointing out that absolutely none of this is anywhere in the Bible. Why is William Lane Craig better able to articulate this issue than God? How does this look anything but post hoc? Plus, I'm not sure how we square the idea of God's unchanging moral nature with the Old Covenant-New Covenant view in Christian theology. God had one set of moral rules for us to obey, and then he just changed them. According to the Christian worldview, one week it was objectively moral to stone your non-virgin bride on her father's doorstep, and then the next week it was objectively morally wrong. At least on its face, it seems like rules based on a perfect moral nature wouldn't change very often. Euthyphro's dilemma is further complicated by the problem of holiness, which we covered back in episode 6, and that was actually one of my favorite episodes. So if some of this sounds familiar to you, that's why. If the apologist takes the third horn, they still have to define God's goodness or holiness. Let's assume the apologist can answer all the criticisms we leveled against the third horn a minute ago. So if we accept their explanation, goodness is an intrinsic part of God's nature. God's nature is somehow not arbitrary, and his good nature is also not matching an external standard of goodness. That doesn't make any sense to me, but let's just swallow that pill. Even if we grant the third horn, we still have an intelligibility problem. What do we mean by God's goodness? I ask this because God's actions and commands are inconsistent. God doesn't hold himself to the same standard that we are expected to follow. What does it even mean to say that God's nature is good if there is no coherent definition of goodness that can be derived from God's actions and commands? And secondly, how are there objective moral rules if we aren't allowed to break them, but the most moral being in the universe is allowed to break them? Let me defend my claim that God often breaks the rules that we're expected to follow. In God's perfect word, he commits multiple genocides that include children, including one that killed almost the entire human race. In 2 Samuel, God massacres 70,000 Israelites because David didn't follow his instructions while taking a census. In 2 Chronicles 18:22, God puts lies in the mouths of the prophets. In 2 Thessalonians 2:11, he sends a spirit of delusion so that people will believe in what is false and not be saved. In 1 Samuel 16:2, he instructs prophets to lie. He tells us that jealousy is a sin in 1 Corinthians 3:3, but tells us that he is a jealous God in Exodus 20, verse 5. This means that God's goodness is not different in degree from the standards of human goodness that he has given to us, but must be different in kind. It's not that he's better than us because he follows some rules of morality to a perfect degree. He is following another standard altogether. Since God appears to be held to a different set of standards than the ones to which humans are held, I want to know what those standards are, and an answer to this challenge will help make God's goodness intelligible. Name one action that God can't perform because it would corrupt his holiness. If God did X, he would no longer be good. Just one action would technically be enough. We wouldn't exactly have a robust understanding of what holy means, but at least it would have some meaning. You can say goodness is essential to God's nature, but if you can't explain what goodness means, the dilemma is even more devastating than when we started. This problem is further compounded by God's willingness to lie. You may want to go to the Bible to look for something God can't do, so we can understand what goodness means, but because God is apparently very comfortable with deception, as he demonstrates in 2 Chronicles 18:22, 2 Thessalonians 2:11, and 1 Samuel 16:2, we can't trust anything God says about himself. If God's goodness cannot be defined meaningfully, we must simply define God's goodness in a circular fashion. Whatever God does, by definition, is good. This leaves us with might makes right, or the divine command theory horn of Euthyphro's dilemma, which makes God amoral and nothing more. Goodness is also not based on God's immutable nature, because what he commands changes from Bible story to Bible story, and also from the Old Covenant to the New Covenant. It's also not really objective, because we are expected to follow a standard that he himself doesn't follow. This inevitably leaves us with the conclusion that God's authority on morality only comes from power and force. If this is the case, there's nothing good about God. He's just more powerful than we are. His moral authority comes from force, and nothing else. That's all I have for you today. I have new patrons to thank: Chris Carr, Rosiah Taylor, and Sarah. I also have to thank Peach Machine, who is at the highest level of support and is thus inducted into the Patron Hall of Fame. Thank you, Chris, Rosiah, Sarah, and Peach Machine. And thanks to all my lovely patrons who support Counter Apologetics. It's the only objectively moral thing in the universe, and your virtue is something we can all aspire to. And you too can be objectively moral by supporting this show on a per-episode basis at patreon.com/counter, where you can earn early access to every episode and access to bonus episodes. If you don't have the money to support on Patreon, but you still want to continue with your whole atheism phase, you can like us on our social media, leave a 5-star review, or tell your friends about the podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by the band Wailers. The song is called Magic Tricks and was used with permission. Thank you for joining me today. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.